Do you realize that you will be able to see and work with elementals?
Absolutely. We're already friends, as is my dog, Titch. Animals see them and regret that you can't. But Mother Earth is eager to transform and take on a new guise not destroyed by human economic transactions, their toxins, and egotistical felling of forests, crucial to wildlife and oxygen production. You should know that our technology is light years ahead of yours. We will share our knowledge when the time is ripe. There will be many alternatives in communication and entertainment. Each household will be supplied with a machine which transforms light energy into matter. It will provide you with clothes and food. There will be prosperity programs which will provide the financial resources necessary. None of this can be revealed in detail before notification of the first wave of changes. You will have new methods of transportation, making cars, trains, and airplanes obsolete. Great changes await transport and infrastructure. New technology will transform medicine. Our technology will reverse the terrible pollution surrounding you. Your entire environment will change fast. There will be no wars. People are brothers and sisters across the world. You will be able to travel across the universe. There will be complete intergalactic cooperation. This is just a fraction of your immediate future. Sicily and Timothy, you must both understand that your powers will be used to the utmost in this amazing transformation, which has been planned by the Galactic Council for thousands of years. I have to leave now, but I will return, as we're part of a group who will coordinate on various missions here and on Earth. As quickly as he had come, Master Alberto Abutters, creator of this new epoch, vanished. I sat as if stunned, until my wife hugged me. Her face was streaked with tears of happiness. We're the chosen ones who will help the Earth back into the fold of the Creator, the Great Spirit, which is the cosmic source of the universe, she sniffed. I was glad that I would be able to tell Grandmother and her husband next morning. They were bound to have a mission, too, in this changing world. Next headline. 28. Indian Wisdom and the Fire of Life. Valencio knocked on my door. He appeared totally elated. Manol was behind him, smiling from ear to ear. I've never seen anyone else do this, but he was expert at it. It's going to be an exciting day, exclaimed Val. We're going to meet Indians. Let me go first, boy. Manol scolded. I'll explain. He sat down with me and my wife. Val initiated a hugging session with Titch. Indians have lived in Agartha since the formation of the continent, Manol told us. You've just met one of them, Alberto Abutters, a man you will meet again soon. Indian culture is as old as time and has been appreciated here most of all. Most Indians are five-dimensional. A very few, those who have only just arrived, are three-dimensional. The ones who have lived here down the ages are considered the wisest of all. We have secret contact with some present-day tribes. They have entrances from above and tunnels connecting Peru and elsewhere. They have a wonderful communications network. They are considered traditionalists in Agartha. Their wisdom is infinite, their love unconditional, and their culture the best preserved of all. There is one problem, they are suspicious of strangers. That's why Alberto and I are coming, too. If he wasn't with us, they wouldn't let us in. They have suffered such humiliation from the surface that you need reliable references to be allowed into their kingdom. Forget you are the Pope's son, Val. It's considered a disadvantage. I've always loved Indians, objected Val enthusiastically. I read tons of Indian books when I was small, and I've always thought they were badly treated. And are still, I added. I'm glad to be meeting them. There are no class conflicts here, Manol continued. We are all equal in the face of the Father. But they don't want bad vibes from surface dwellers. That's happened too often. It won't be a problem if we arrive with Alberto. He'll be here any moment. Here we don't generally use expressions of time like any minute, as Agarthans don't live by the clock, but by the signs of nature. But it was only a few minutes before Alberto knocked, and we entered the hovercraft waiting outside.
Enter is a good word, although embark would do just as well, as you climb three steep steps to get into one of these vehicles, which otherwise looks like an open car without wheels. Titch was used to it now, and he was the first one in, sitting in the front, leaving a tiny space for me. Cicilla stayed home, maintaining that she was busy. In actual fact, at my urgent request, she was going to see how the land lay for Val. He was thinking of getting married and was pining for the red-headed madcap, Tira. Cicilla had known Tira's parents from childhood. The way to Indian country was long, but the loveliness I experienced was nearly devastating. There were no deserts or overgrown wildernesses. The land was cultivated, with regular places for rest and meditation. I've never seen so many varieties of flowers as in Agartha. Manal explained that the profusion of flowers was part of the kingdom's root system. It helped to clean the air, achieving positive energy with its perfumed message and contributing to the inhabitants' well-being. We landed gently. I looked around before Titch pulled impatiently at my sleeve to get out. The air was as balmy as Manal had promised, and the landscape a romantic dream. There were no barriers, just endless mountains, lakes, and tall trees, many in blossom. I could see no compact buildings, just wicker walls entwined with plants. Alberto stepped out of the other hovercraft and welcomed us warmly to his region of Agartha. It was truly lovely. There was an occasional totem pole. These were made of precious stones and weren't exactly like the ones on the surface. The play of sunlight on the multitude of beautifully polished stones was blinding. Around them, also decorated in stones, was semicircular seating with cushions. Alberto explained that people would sit here to meditate. Nothing but the true God was worshipped, the source of all creation. Here's the fire of life, announced Alberto, indicating a winding path. We followed the path and soon found ourselves on a hillside. Above us, at the top of the hill, there was a building that gleamed so brightly it hurt our eyes to look at it. The fire of life restores youth and vitality to the visitor, explained Manal. It bestows upon him great clarity of thought and deed, removing any trace of illness and filling him with joie de vivre. All people should be cleansed by it, but that is unfortunately not possible. The powers that be make those decisions. I thought of grandmother and the stories she had told me when I was small, visiting Sweden, about a holy fire that restored youth and happiness. Here it was. I also knew that there was a room in Tilos where youth and vigor could be restored. It was obviously considered important in this strange land. Our health is of paramount importance. Without it we are pitiful craft floating on the ocean of life. On the surface we have doctors and hospitals. But I prefer the health centers of Agartha. Manal informed us that all tribes and villages had similar places. Illness contributed to economic markets on Earth, and was completely unnecessary. We would be able to show them later how to heal. Alberto Abbott has led us through the peculiar, intertwined village so that I could study its strange construction. There were no castles or manor houses, just round or straight walls glimpsed through overwhelmingly luxuriant foliage. Houses are somewhere to live for us. Here they are, incredible constructions, alive with people. We saw people everywhere in gaudy, colorful costumes. They were either running around or busy with old-fashioned jobs. Alberto noticed my confusion, but Valencio anticipated my questions by asking, how do these people make a living? Are there no factories to produce goods they need? To me, this feels like going back hundreds of years. You should know by now that we create all we need, replied Manal abruptly. We still make our own remedies and cures. Children fall down even here, and people get stomach aches, toothaches, and headaches. Accidents happen and we get hurt just like you. We have medicine for everything. The people here are making herbal remedies, collecting herbs and roots in the forests. Do the Aborigines do the same? Val asked. Pretty much, Alberto answered. We have our own traditions. All tribes, whatever the name, have their own culture, but we share the same God, the source, the creator, the word of love which was the word in the beginning. Do you have similar places of worship? It was my turn to ask questions. The various cultures have intentionally diverse places of worship, replied Alberto. People have to feel comfortable in their belief, even if the beliefs are compatible. We respect people's differences. If problems arise, we solve them. You always say that. I protested. Always can be such an uncertain term. Is there someone to turn to if a problem arises, or are the tears shed inwardly in silence? Old Mother Sjalunu is life's servant, replied Alberto. We'll look in on her and you'll get a better answer than I can give you. In a glade beside a huge rock, a woman was sitting on the grass by a fire. She was stirring a cauldron and tasting its contents from time to time. She was small and so thin that her ribs protruded, and her pale face was so wrinkled that there was hardly room for her eyes, nose, and mouth. You would have expected wisps of hair, but to my surprise, I was completely wrong. Old Mother Sjalunu had a mane the lion would have envied. She had gleaming, black hair with curls around her face. She was quite a sight, and she sounded more like a crowing magpie than a human when she spoke. And yet, her words were as clear as embroidery on an otherwise blank canvas. She looked at each of us in turn, and I could feel her gaze was more intense than you would suppose. To what do I owe the pleasure of a visit from fine, healthy folk? She asked, continuing to stir her brew. I'm busy with a cure for the sick, for those who have lost their way from God. They crawl around like lice on a bronze statue. You don't look lost. Alberto leaned over and whispered in her ear. He was rewarded with a toothless smile and a nod. She removed her hand momentarily from the ladle and pointed with a claw-like nail over her left shoulder. We followed Alberto through branches concealing a hole in a great boulder. It was the entrance to a cave. I was again greeted by a sight I was unprepared for. Val grasped my shoulder and whispered, "What is that?" Next headline. 29. Old Mother Sjalunu's gift. We were in quite a roomy cavern, tastefully furnished with seating around a high bench. A restful light pervaded in dull colors. Meditation music played softly in the background. There were armchairs, obviously intended for the therapist and patient. The old lady was suddenly sitting in one of the chairs. How she had gotten there was a mystery. "Is that the patient?" she asked, pointing to Val. Titch had crept shamelessly to her side. Her hand, previously so busy stirring, now stroked my dog softly. "If the boy will sit with me a moment, I'll sort out the mess in his head," Old Mother Sjalunu chirped. "He's madly in love, which makes it more difficult." Val sat down reluctantly in the armchair opposite her. Suddenly, the old lady smiled, and her gnarled hands gripped Val's fists. "That'll have to wait, anyway," she announced, grinning. I realized all of a sudden how much the smile lit up her old face, so that it exuded love and no longer appeared so ancient. "It won't be as easy as he thinks, but it will happen in the end. The young puppy will grow into a fine fellow. But don't give up. Don't let anyone else meddle in your life, as that will be your downfall." Valencio didn't dare say a word. He seemed subdued, but not scared. Can't I marry the one I love?" Val asked querulously. The old lady burst out laughing. "The young rascal wants a woman," she exclaimed. "But didn't he hear what I said? Not yet. It will happen in due course. Here, now is always now. It can only be like that until the next now is ready. He has to understand that if he's staying." And with that cryptic reply he had to be satisfied. As he got up, the old lady seized his arm. "Don't be in such a hurry. Make haste slowly. Play first before you settle down." True to his upbringing, the Pope's son politely kissed her hand. Old Mother Sjalunu was surprised and delighted. Then she pointed at me. "Come to me, Cecilia's husband. I have something for you." She was still stroking Tich's neck, which he was enjoying to no end. "Sit down," she ordered, as though I were a dog. I did so. "Shut your eyes," she commanded, and I did that too.
I felt two fingers vibrating on my eyelids and tremendous warmth. Timothy needs to be able to see more, she explained. He's married into one of our best families, and he has to be able to keep up. He didn't have the gift, but I've given it to him. She swept her hands once more across my brow, and I felt a sharp pain in my head, then a sensation like falling into something nice and warm. You'll need to get used to seeing more than usual, she commented. When you open your eyes, you'll realize that I'm not what I seemed. Open up and have a look. Where had the old witch with the gleaming hair gone? I recognized the raven tresses, but underneath were happy blue eyes regarding me. These looked out from a pretty face, as beautiful as a rose, with a smile revealing pearly white teeth. If I had not worshipped my wife, I would have been pierced by Cupid's arrow immediately. At the edge of this vision were Manuel and Alberto, curled up laughing. Valencio was on the floor, his mouth gaping. Titch was with him, licking his ear to restore him to reality, doggy reality, at least. What a gift you've been given! Manuel exclaimed. Now you'll be able to see the person inside everyone you meet. You'll become a true judge of character, Tim, and you'll see even more in the future. I rubbed my eyes and turned to hug the beautiful witch, but there were only us visitors there, Manuel, Alberto, Val, Titch, and me. I left the cave with the two masters as if in a trance. There sat old Mother Sjaluna, stirring her pot. Simultaneously, I could make out a diaphanous figure at her side, the beautiful girl from the cavern, the girl inside Sjaluna. I rushed to hug the old lady, nearly upsetting the cauldron, but she steadied it swiftly and turned on me resentfully. You're in too much hurry, Cecilia's husband, she hissed. Save your mollycoddling for your wife and go on ferreting about for the Aborigines next. My chortling companions waved farewell to her and so did Val and I. Old Mother Sjaluna didn't take any notice of us, but stayed stirring her pot of herbs. Next headline. 30. With the Aborigines. The Aborigines were at some distance. We had to go in the hovercraft, I called it our Rolls Royce. I had hardly awoken from the enchanted mist of Old Mother Sjaluna's, when the craft thudded to an abrupt stop. We were in a small valley surrounded by trees. A jumble of boulders lay around, as if strewn there by a giant hand, grass pushing up between them. A wide stream, wide enough to be a river, flowed through the valley. The Aborigines were everywhere, collecting water, bathing, chatting vociferously, clad in little butter loin cloth. They called and waved to us in their friendly, happy way. A tall, lithe man, his gleaming brown skin still dripping, came striding towards us. He wore a spotlessly clean, white loincloth of minimal size. Welcome. He called, reaching out a hand. I'm Toomey. You're all very welcome. We're cooking for you over there in the clearing. He pointed towards a small boulder, but we couldn't see much. A little bird told us you were on your way, he continued. There were no birds involved in the deafening concert that started up. Five naked young boys were playing didgeridoos, those long wind instruments that Aborigines play. Titch buried his muzzle in my arm. The music wasn't really to his taste, but it didn't last long. Then we traipsed after Toomey, who was at least 7 feet tall in his bare feet, around the rocks where an amazing sight met our eyes. A group of lovely, dark-haired girls, clad in flowers, danced and sang around a long table on which all kinds of tempting food was arrayed. I gripped Titch's collar as his eyes lit up, and wished I could have restrained Val in the same way, as he seemed inclined to throw himself on the food straight away. Luckily, he was too well brought up, in spite of his hunger, and he came and stood behind me instead. This is to honor our guests, cried Toomey. We'll say grace first, and then please eat up. The food nymphs hummed gently as he called loudly and clearly, thank you, Eternal Father, for your grace in giving us food for ourselves and our honored guests. May all food and drink run through our bodies, rendering them fit for your divine purpose. No life has been sacrificed for this blessed feast, but nature has supplied it from her riches. Thanks, oh thanks. We started in on the food, which could have been made by gods. As we were eating, I noticed something strange. Each person I looked at seemed to radiate their own aura. They were perfectly clear, in various colors. At this juncture, I didn't realize that this was an inner glow revealed to me so that I could read people like a book. This was the gift from old Mother Star Luna. There was a terrified shriek from Valencio, son of the Pope. He was brandishing a lid, which he had presumably removed from one of the dishes, and was staring in horror at the serving platter. A 10-year-old child, who had noticed our dismay, giggled wildly, removed a worm from the plate, and consumed it like spaghetti. It would have been fine if it had been spaghetti. No life had been sacrificed for our feast. It was true. These worms were wriggling with life. Val rushed away, probably to be sick, and I asked Manal, who was standing nearby, what was going on. He grinned in delight. The Aborigines eat a certain type of worm alive. It's considered a real treat. It's the only exception to Agatha's vegetarian diet. You don't have to try it. There are plenty of other dishes. Titch and I exchanged glances. He lay down with his muzzle in his paws. It meant no. I'd lost my appetite, so the dog and I left the table, with a nod from Manal, who didn't seem fond of worm consumption either. The Aborigines continue to eat worms to this day. Toomey followed us, looking concerned. I'm sorry if you didn't appreciate our food, he said, but stay a while. We are going to dance at the edge of the forest. We have story dances. Many of our legends are exceptionally lovely, and we have set them to music of our own composition. We will eat sunstone bread at the same time. It's guaranteed worm-free. We laughed, and accepted his invitation. He took us to an open-air theater where we sat down on a grassy slope. We've plenty of amphitheaters in Italy, Val commented. It's lovely here. At the bottom of the slope was a natural stage, surrounded by trees, with a babbling brook flowing between glistening stones. We were given bread and drink which tasted wonderful. The beautiful dancing girls returned, graceful and gentle. Then there were trolls and creeping figures with animal masks. The girls were scared off before our horrified eyes, and a gruesome scene replaced them. It was a war between the forces of good and evil, fought violently. It was horribly realistic, and I noticed that Val had shut his eyes. The special effects were amazing, and body parts, heads, arms, and legs, floated around. On closer inspection, it was apparent that puppets were used. There was a happy ending, the blaring music calmed down, and the girls returned with their cheerful dance. Our two masters thanked Toomey for the refreshments and entertainment and explained that we had to go. Soon we were back in the Rolls Royce, a light breeze smelling of the sea below us. What did we learn from the Aborigines? Val asked. Eating worms, yuck. But it was fun, too. You learned how people live at one with nature, how they create music and drama, and how they are satisfied with their lives, Manal pointed out. We're going home now, and we'll carry on tomorrow. Next headline. 31. The birthplace of mankind, Africa. Occasionally, we find ourselves in a land directly beneath the earthly kingdom which is its birthplace, remarked Manal, slightly obscurely, as we were sitting in the hovercraft the next day. Where would that be? I wondered. Africa. Was the answer. Africa is enormous, with many lands and innumerable tribes, Valencio observed thoughtfully. Where exactly are we going? You'll see in a moment, Alberto replied in a tone of voice that brooked no argument. The craft swooped gently down onto sand sculpted by the wind into wide circles in all directions. This was unmistakably the desert. That's all we need, I thought, a tribe from the African desert. I sat on the steps of our vehicle trying to remove the sand from Titch's muzzle. Val and the two masters walked around this seemingly uninhabited spot, until we all heard a loud, shrill call that became more resonant. As if from nowhere, there appeared dark-skinned warriors armed with crescent-shaped spears. They were naked, apart from loincloth.
depths, and their skin gleamed in the sun. They were painted with white stripes and other characters, and had feathers on their heads. Some of them had feathers fastened behind, giving the impression of birds. They rolled their eyes and seemed terrifying. Val moved closer to the masters, who were holding out their hands towards the tribe. To my surprise, I noticed rings of light swarming around their hands like huge insects. The tribe took a step back and fell to their knees in front of Alberto and Manal. The rings of light had obviously made an impression. A man at least 7 feet tall got up from the group and approached us. I couldn't understand what he said, but Alberto spoke to him. It was a long conversation. In the end, the tall man beckoned us to follow him, which we did. We were still in the desert, but it was no longer empty. Small, conical huts were silhouetted against the intense blue sky, smoke arising from them. A young woman with ebony skin and tightly curled hair piled high on her head approached us. She was strangely beautiful in her foreign way. She wore a gold cloth at her waist, was painted in yellow and gold, and was weighed down with jewelry. She stood before the masters, and they all bowed to each other. Gold glittered from her arms, neck, and waist, and on her feet were gold sandals laced high up her legs with gold ribbon. Her skin was even darker than the tall man's. "This is Yola, the Gold Queen," the tall man introduced her. "You are in Euria, the birthplace of mankind. From here all races on the earth originated." We could understand him, and we understood what the Gold Queen said when she started talking. We sat on the sand, and she perched on a sort of woven gold throne that was brought for her and which gleamed like the sun. "You strangers desire to see the birthplace," she said, in more strident tones than we had expected. "This village was created so long ago that the surface of the earth was still not formed. Heaven created us in his image. Heaven took the trouble of giving us human inheritance. We went to the surface, where we were betrayed and disappointed. The survivors returned here. People who we were going to confirm as true children of heaven betrayed us with the help of the evil king's war, power, and selfishness, and he remained in power. His name was Anu and his followers were called the Anunnaki. He and his followers have finally fled to their own planet. People on the surface will be given the chance to become what was originally intended. The children of heaven will regain their origin. Anu held them fettered by evil, and the evil brought darkness of thought and feeling. Some of the children of heaven luckily managed to retain their generosity, love, and integrity, and they will help us now. We have grieved for the earth as a cherished relative, but our grief has changed to joy. We have great help from other planets and we're planning a UFO visit to enlighten the surface dwellers about their wonderful inheritance. As above, so below," I interrupted her. "Where does that come from?" "It's the very first decree which heaven taught us," the queen replied. "That's how it was meant to be, and will be in the future. Knowledge meant ego triumphed over spirit, that is what happened. It was warm, like a hot summer's day on the surface. We were treated to cooling drinks and lively conversation with the attractive Queen Mother, as she turned out to be, and her court. On the surface, we don't believe that the earth is so ancient and its culture so extensive. Yola had a choir which sang madrigal-like songs. They were herding songs from the goat herders. The goats had longer horns and shorter coats than we are used to, because of the heat. The village was sizable and scattered across a wide area. The sand dunes and the desert finished pretty much where we had landed. Long grass and flowers replaced it further on, including a cactus resembling an orchid which I had never seen before. The people were such a mixture, both black and white. Yolu explained that it was heaven's original plan that all people should live together, but that difference is increased as the surface was populated. As we entered the town, the houses changed. Here there were more normal houses, almost like English cottages, with clay walls and thatched roofs. Chimneys didn't exist, as it was so hot, and food was cooked outside. The kitchens were like booths, but to judge from the food, they were perfect for cooking in. By the time we were ready to go, we were almost overwhelmed by music, great vegetarian food, and the joy emanating from this magical place. "Are we going to China, too?" the inquisitive Val asked.